Oye, grande, con niña, niña.
Hi, long time no here. I hope you all are doing fine. In this episode, I talked to Teresa Montoya and Mark Emerson about their recent article titled "Confronting Legacies of Structural Racism and Settler Colonialism to Understand COVID-19 Impacts on the Navajo Nation." In this article, they discuss public health in relation to the ongoing pandemic of COVID-19 within the Navajo Nation, as well as understanding settler colonial violence and the health impacts that are felt today, and also connecting it to lessons from the 1918 flu. Finally, we discuss the limitations of Western epistemology and think through ideas of relational care in consideration of Navajo epistemology and ontology and relationality such as k'e'. I want to say thank you to Teresa Montoya and Mark Emerson for their time. And if you're interested in reading the article, DM me and I will send you an email with the PDF attached. Thank you for listening. This is the Wish Day Podcast.
Yat e she e Teresa Montoya yene she tatne zani nishle biligane bashish chin a shihe dashiche ado nakaite ne dashanele.
Yeah, I'm a provost postdoc at the University of Chicago, incoming assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology. I teach a lot of classes on Native studies. A lot of my research looks at jurisdictional challenges around environmental regulation on Navajo Nation. And of course, all of this brings up concerns of public health. So my own interests as a researcher, but also personally as someone who's been a caregiver until quite recently for my late grandfather, has given me a lot of insight into some of the challenges of public health on the Navajo Nation. And so I was really excited to be able to think alongside Mark, who's actually trained in public health, and who also has some of these personal circumstances, you know, family care in his own family. So we really just wanted to use this as an opportunity to think together, especially around this crisis that has taken on a very different trajectory for tribal nations, but most especially the Navajo Nation.
Yeah, Teresa, that's a great intro. I really like the tie-in there. So Yate She Ya Mark Emerson Nishne, Aro Mai Desh Gijne Nishne, Sena Bithni Basha Chin, Toglimi Desh Che, Mai Desh Gijne Deshanali. So I'm Mark, originally from Shiprock, from Setakon area, so near Shiprock, currently in North Carolina. And so I am an incoming new faculty. I'm an assistant professor of epidemiology in the Dilling School of Global Public Health at UNC. And my training is in cancer epidemiology. Yeah, I guess kind of tying in with what Teresa's saying in my intro is a lot of this has been like the, you know, growing up on the res and growing up on the farm, it's been like this journey to where I'm at now to like, that's been like, it's been a journey for sure, like the good and the bad. And so I think at the end of it all, like one thing that's come out is being able to have some context or some like language and some like new skills to be able to like think about the context of which we grew up in and like have some language now looking back to like, oh yeah, these are the things that were like what we now call like social determinants of health, or like these are how things kind of impact systemically in terms of outcomes that affect chronic disease. And so like Teresa was saying, like a lot of that comes from experience that we can all, I think, relate to with caring for our relatives, caring for our family members, and seeing like what this disparity looks like when it's thinking about how we access care, quality of care, issues like that. And so, yeah, again, just really pumped to be here. And I guess like in the end, like the podcast is like no one will see, but I was telling Teresa yesterday, I was like pumped for this. And so like my background here is like, I'm trying to lean into your title, Ushti, like vibes here. So this is like verbal description, whatever. So this is like my house on Insetacon near Shiprock, my dad's house, who passed away from a late stage stomach cancer. But like, I just feel like channeling that vibe. I have my coffee here, so I'm ready for some good combo. Cause this was always like a place that table, again, like people can't like see actually what I'm saying probably at the end, but this table here was just like a good place for a combo, you know, that my dad would bring in community for. And like, we'd have these conversations and it's all kind of land-based, right? And like connected to that responsibility for our community, our responsibility for the land. And I feel like that kind of creates the context of that overall, just welcoming combo vibe of like community and this kind of conversation. So I'll just end that intro there. And just, dude, I just really appreciate you coming and like creating the space for us. And I'm just really grateful to be a part of this conversation today.
It helps that I'm also in Shiprock and there's a fly that like keeps buzzing and I'm afraid it's going to land on my face, but whatever. So you two recently published a paper. I thought it was really good because I think it connects something that I'm very familiar with, but something I'm not very familiar with, which is ideas of settler colonialism. You know, I think all of us experience it in some way on the reservation, but also outside of it. But I really can't say much about public health. And so I was wondering maybe if either of you could give an idea as to what public health is, and then maybe expand on how we can critically look at public health.
Yeah, thanks, Marley. And also, Mark completely tricked me because I was really confused.
I would never.
I was like, he's in North Carolina? I was like, no. And that's when I realized that that was a backdrop. I was like, oh my God, he's at home. That's awesome.
You know, I did show. Wow. I was like, wow, that home looks really Navajo to be North Carolina, but who am I to judge?
No, I thought you, I was like, oh, maybe that's a surprise. He's actually like back home.
Oh my God. And it would be a dream come true if like my light was this strong, if I was actually like on the phone right now.
Well, I think your lighting of like where you are actually matches the backdrop really well. Yeah,
definitely,
you
know, the lighting.
So, I mean, kudos to you.
That was all on purpose, obviously.
That was really great, Mark.
It was meticulous planning of the lighting.
Yeah.
Okay, no, but serious talk now. yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about some of the prompts that you had given us, you know, around settler colonialism and public health. Again, my part, and especially my own research interest, is in water, right? And there was actually an article published last year, one by an Indigenous scholar, Desi Rodriguez Lone Bear. And in that study, she's a sociologist, but they looked at a lot of, meaning they used, you know, qualitative data, but they correlated households that didn't have running water or lacked indoor plumbing alongside tribal nations that had a higher incidence of positivity rates. And what they found from that study was that tribal households that lacked indoor plumbing actually had a higher incidence of COVID. You know, so there's limitations to that sort of data, as we all know, coming both you and I, Marley, from a more social science or quantitative background. However, I think these insights are actually quite informative, right? And across the board, we can see that, you know, lack of access to running water, indoor plumbing, you know, water infrastructure writ large actually has profound impacts on the day-to-day lives for Diné communities. And that is not only an environmental issue, you know, stemming from a long legacy of contamination, toxic exposure, uranium, coal fire ash, all of that, but also, you know, in a public health crisis, the ability for people to wash their hands, because that was one of the main early interventions or suggestions as, you know, public health officials were trying to understand what was going on with this pandemic early in 2020. You know, at first it was, okay, wash your hands, you know, use hand sanitizer. I always actually thought it was kind of curious that the recommendation to wear masks didn't come until months after, even though we already had some experience with previous SARS outbreaks, but that's a, a whole nother concern. So yeah, I mean, just the simple fact that many Diné households, you know, over 40% of households, which is a significant number, don't have running water, means that a simple act of washing your hands or other hygienic activities is made more difficult. Another thing that I'll mention here, I think that is all quite obvious to us, but maybe not so obvious to non-Diné or other folks in more urban settings is, you know, just the intergenerational household. You know, a lot of Diné families will live together in close quarters still. So of course that makes disease transmission something that's harder to control. But the flip side of this, and I will say, like, looking at a lot of these earlier anthropological reports about the 1918 flu, there's similar narratives, right, of, you know, lack of access to Western medicine as being as an impediment. So like, basically, it's like, oh, Navajo culture or Navajo traditional knowledge, you know, is seen as an impediment to our health. Mm-hmm. And like the lack of access to Western medicine. And I think what Mark and I were trying to say in this paper, and it's something that we would love to talk about more in detail, you know, it's just the importance of ke and kinship. It's like, yes, we have crowded households and we don't have access to indoor plumbing. However, I think one of the reasons why the Navajo Nation was so successful in its vaccination campaign was because of there was this notion of community care, of relational care, you know, trumping whatever these concerns around personal freedom are, or, you know, not wanting to mask up. So there's much more to say about that, but those are kind of my overall impressions from that question.
I didn't really think about that in terms of the political rights that are usually deployed versus how Navajo people might actually deploy another form of relationality. By you contrasting them, to me, it points to like a political understanding of geh. Mark, did you want to add anything? What is public health?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And also, again, hype man for Teresa, just because like, I feel like her answer hit on like everything that like is really important in like kind of structuring or framing this conversation. For sure. So I guess kind of in a nutshell, how I think of public health basically is just like, I just want to say ditto for like what Teresa's talking about, because it really is thinking about what are these tie-ins for all these other things that can relate to health. And so, you know, I think there's kind of like this textbook definition, and then also just like kind of what we are just feel and know in our bones in terms of like how these environmental things, how these cultural things, how we grew up, how we're living our life now, how our diet, how our interactions with the environment, like how those all tie into our health overall, whether that's like acute health day to day, or that's a chronic condition that can happen over time, like cancer. And that's my substantive area. So within like the greater field of public health, which is tying in all these different things, which could be like policy issues, or which can be like more in the field kind of things, and looking at chronic disease or looking at infectious disease. Yeah, not like I'm going to sleep, but it's within epidemiology, which is arguably a field, a subfield of science. There's like debate within our own. And I will just add the disclaimer that all the like mistakes I make about describing whatever are my own right here. So like within epidemiology, there's like kind of some non-consensus, I would say, overall, like if it is a science or not technically. And so I think of epidemiology more as this toolbox to really like help think about study design, to think about determinants of health within a population. So that could be a community, that could be a state, that could be a whole country. And so within that, I think what I'll add here is kind of like framing out or contextualizing what Teresa's talking about. And I feel like what we all kind of like know is right now there's, I think, a lot of work to be done in terms of what your question was and what that critical expansion of public health could look like. And I think that has a lot to do with like this overall, how do we think about, like overall, basically it's like we have an exposure, whatever that could look like, and then we have an outcome. So it could be something like diet overall, and then the outcome could just be body weight or something like that, right? And so it's like trying to have this framework within epidemiology to link the exposure to this outcome. But there's so many things that could like affect those things, right? And so we call those kind of like these in-between things. We can call them confounders or mediators. And so it's critically thinking about adding more variables to how we think about these issues, or how we think about these conditions, or how we think about these, within my work, it's how we think about this like further widening of disparity when it comes to those who have and those who don't, right? And so not to like get too like theoretical, but those like variables that were missing, I think that is something that we need to critically expand. And I think when framing it within this context of our conversation, it's those things that Teresa is talking about. It's thinking about water, it's thinking about accessing healthy food, it's thinking about multi-generational homes, it's thinking about these things. And often like a lot of studies, you know, are just kind of throwing up their hands like, oh, we don't have those variables to really like track within our data set. And so I think, you know, that's how we can critically start thinking about that expansion of public health is being more inclusive, being more mindful, being more thoughtful of how we're incorporating these variables into these analysis that we're doing that eventually have some kind of outcome. And the last thing I'll say is the last two things real quick is that Teresa reminded me of is like even this commentary that we wrote kind of started originally, like I read this article in the New York Times and it was, I think, the mayor of Grants. And it was kind of just this racism of border towns that were basically like, oh, Navajos are coming in or off into our border town and like giving us COVID or whatever. Like that was his overall vibe, right? It was just a hardcore like and racist vibe where it's just like they're bringing in disease into our community. And so that was kind of the like underlying basis of like collaborating with Teresa on this. That was kind of like in some of the original drafts that kind of like was the impetus for like thinking about this paper. And then the other thing is like, it also, I think another underpinning problem within public health is that it's always kind of this deficit-based thing, right? It's like have too much of the bad things or not enough of the good things, right? Like we don't have enough money, we have too much diabetes, we're not educated, can like really get problematic when it's like these things that are just linked in, right? And that's how maybe we can get to a point where like the Grants mayor is just like, oh, you know, these like brown kids coming in, they're all like messing things up or they're like not adding any value when it's the other way around. And that's the kind of that relationality that I think Teresa is talking about in terms of how can we use that, incorporate that as a quote unquote variable, right? To like make it less deficit based because we have our own ways of knowing. And like Teresa's saying, like those don't necessarily have to be like totally unmarried from other things like fields that we're currently all studying, right? From like geography, anthropology, from public health, epidemiology, we can still like use those things.
One thing that I thought was really interesting trying to synthesize everything is this idea that what you're pulling from that news article. I thought you were going to talk about Page, Arizona. I don't know, because that's where I'm coming from, the GE area. And then during the pandemic, they had the same type of narrative that were going around. The mayor was racializing COVID. And there were people in Page who were saying threatening violence against Navajos because they assumed that Navajo people were the sole carriers. And I like this idea that you have when the narrative is solely based on like deficit or lacking or having too much of something that's bad, it falls into like this discrete, it creates discrete categories rather than being like a relational understanding. When you have those types of like framings, it the tendency is victim blaming, like, oh, it's an internal problem. It's and it parallels a lot of the ideas of like, you know, it's their fault. The person I'm referring to is a feminist geographer, Doreen Massey, who's like, no, we need a more relational geography that shows that these things are related. And I think that's what the framework of settler colonialism does, is it shows that these aren't just discrete things that are happening. Like the Navajo Nation isn't inherently underdeveloped or lacking of. It's actually a process of political forces and economic forces, patriarchal forces, but all the forces there are, they're continuously kind of working around that can't be categorized as something discrete or
Yeah. And I think a quick plug for what you're talking about, I think your like third or fourth episode with Becky, I think like it outlines like, or you guys go a little bit more into depth in that too, in a really good way. I feel like you guys had a good conversation in that.
It sounds like you listened to it. So I'm
that specifically. So plug, go back to like episode 3 or whatever. It's a good one.
Go check out episode 3. Anyways, as I read the article, seeing this idea of like relations at the like micro level of talking about and then, you know, thinking it when I as I understand settler colonial geographies is very relational. Like it's thinking not just within terms of reservations, it's expansive. And I do like that. I like that you're pushing it, like you're providing an alternative narrative that's counters the underdevelopment aspect of things that I tend to get pulled into. And I'm trying to move away from that. What I was going to kind of transition to is this point. You draw upon the flu of 1918. I think it's the Spanish flu. And I was wondering, what are some things that you pulled from looking at that historical moment within the Navajo Nation?
Yeah. So as Mark mentioned, you know, his emergent interest in thinking about this paper or what would become our paper at the same exact time, I was stuck here over Christmas in Chicago, right? So I always go home during the holidays. My family's in Winter Rock. But because that was the spike, the winter spike, I made the difficult decision to stay here, which meant me being in my apartment alone through the holidays. And that was really difficult, you know, to be away from family. And so I kind of just threw myself into reading, and maybe I'm a glutton for punishment, but then I started reading about the 1918 flu. And I was really interested in looking at these historical accounts, anything that I could find on the internet through, you know, my institutional access to the library. You know, what were folks saying, you know, a century ago about the flu on the Navajo Nation? And of course, what was being written back then was by Indian agents and anthropologists and government officials. So much more that I could, you know, investigate with this. But, you know, over the course of those couple weeks during winter break, you know, I came across a few of these resources, one of which is from this book by an anthropologist, Charlotte Frisbee. And she translated Rose Mitchell telling this story. There's a whole chapter. It's basically an oral history of the 1918 flu. So for me, that was kind of my entry into trying to investigate some of these broader social circumstances and understandings of the flu, both from an outside Biligana perspective, but then also trying to understand, well, what were the Diné ways of approaching this sickness? I will not try to translate or to say in Diné Bizaj the term, because I know I'm going to butcher it horribly, but the phrase translated into English for the Spanish flu is during the time the flu killed. And that translation I actually had gotten from Nicole Horsherder. So gratitude to her for providing the correct orthography and also some of the understanding of that terminology. But I mean, the Spanish flu at the time, you know, it killed 675,000 Americans. And actually I just saw in the news this week, as of Monday, the US has now surpassed that threshold. So up until now, the 1918 flu has remained this like pinnacle of the past century, right? That, oh, well, we're not yet at that threshold. Not as many Americans have died from COVID as they have from the 1918 flu. Well, we are now at that point. As of this week, we have surpassed that. So yeah, over 675,000 Americans have now died from COVID. And it just in this short news article, you know, they saw, you know, these public health officials were saying, you know, there's only so many correlations we can draw between, you know, COVID in 2021 versus the Spanish flu. But I do think, you know, from a social scientist perspective and also wanting to draw together these connections that set with colonialism is there are some things that remain the same, which is lack of access to medical facilities, right? So from some of these reports that I had read, you know, Navajo communities that fared better during the 1918 flu were ones that were closer to hospitals. But of course, we have to question, like, well, who are writing these reports? So of course, they're going to write analyses that uphold the you know, supremacy of Western medicine as like the only way to address these problems. Where I also had read, you know, through some of these narratives that the Navajos had an understanding that, oh, if someone gets sick, maybe we try to isolate them. Of course, especially back then of, you know, multi-generational households living in a hogan, that was not always possible. But I think there was already some understanding of what we could now call public health. Mm-hmm. And we have, of course, our own ceremonial restrictions, right? I mean, if you think about like after you undergo a ceremony and you don't touch, shake hands. I mean, these are things that actually kind of correspond with what we consider public health measures.
Yeah. And just to add in real quickly, right? Like, this is a critical point, like that we have always known public health. Like, there's the practice or the science of public health, right? And then there's like the what we have been doing as the peoples forever. And like that knowledge is like,
yeah, no, I mean, and these are like the things that Mark and I wanted to be co-developing together. I mean, as someone who's also not trained in public health, so I didn't always have the language to describe these things. And I mean, I think one of the great outcomes of this paper, even though it was so short, like we had severe limitations in terms of how much we could write, and we have a maximum like 25 citations that we can include, but there was so much more that we wanted to include. But I think throughout this process, we had so many conversations about what was happening on the ground and sharing different resources. So, I mean, for me in a personal way, like this has just been extremely educational because this like helped, you know, form this longer term collaboration. And Mark and I have other ideas for, you know, trying to bring together, you know, environmental health and public health and, you know, social science disciplines and methodologies to try to understand, you know, for instance, like uranium contamination or, you know, other issues. So we're constantly thinking of these sorts of interdisciplinary collaborations, but also, you know, how can we bridge our limited understandings of Diné epistemology? And when I say this as someone who's grown up around the Navajo Nation, who's, you know, spent the majority of my life always coming back to the Navajo Nation, but as someone who also doesn't speak Diné Bizaad fluently, which, you know, I will be the first to admit that limits my own understanding of, you know, the totality of Navajo knowledge. With that being said, I, you know, there's so much that, you know, kind of bringing Western knowledge to bear on like its own limitations for understanding, like what we could call a Diné public health, just like, you know, sovereignty frameworks, for instance. You know, we don't have a term for sovereignty. There's been a lot of discussion and debate around like what sovereignty means to different tribal nations, the Navajo Nation. It's like, but there's already pre-existing concepts of that, even if it doesn't translate the same way, even if it's not based on these European notions of of hierarchy and power. So yeah, I think, you know, this is just the beginning of a longer conversation. And, you know, unfortunately it took COVID for us to come together and have these discussions, but I'm hopeful now that we can also think more about how it can be included in discussions of public health interventions.
Did you want to add anything, Mark?
I feel like it's also important, like, just like this encouragement, like I also have my like limitations too, including like fluency of language and like some other things. I feel like one is this idea of like being responsible to a place. I think that's so critical, and like having this place-based knowledge. And so, you know, that's a limitation from being here in North Carolina, right? And not like thinking through these things within the community. While we don't like maybe know all these things, I feel like my dad would always remind me like, but you do, you know, like it's in your blood. It's like in our blood, it's in our bones that we carry that knowledge forward and like to like be encouraged by for the work that we're trying to do. And so those two metaphors are kind of like, I think of overlaying one over the other. Like we have this like Western knowledge or whatever you want to call it. And then we have like the non-Western knowledge or whatever you want to call it, traditional or indigenous. I feel like none of them are really super inclusive or perfect terms, but like I feel like it's kind of like this sifting idea where there's deficits on both ends and like, or limitations, or like when you kind of overlay them, like it's interesting kind of what falls out. And that's kind of how I like mentally picture like work that like we're all doing. And the other one's kind of just like this pendulum idea. Like I think like how this like pendulum swings is like important in terms of like thinking through some of these things where we're having this, like, I feel like momentous moment, especially like with public health and within COVID and thinking about what those deficits or limitations look like. And I feel like each of us, while we may not be like card carrying, like public health people or whatever, like we just see those in our community, or like we hear those narratives. What are these ways that we can like start to think about health in our own community and like based within like our own like ways of knowing or our own values of like how we identify or how we even define health, you know?
One thing that drew me to this is pretty much summed up again by both of what you said is that these material conditions are actually very similar and that the power relations then are still entrenched right now. And combining what both of you said is that like public health is this knowledge that is not just reserved for those who are in the position of going to school and whatnot. It's something that everybody kind of has a sense of, but also at the same time, it's kind of intergenerational. You know, the stories that we hear from our grandparents about what they went through kind of instills in sense of us a sense of public knowledge. this goes back to this question about like, what is public health? And just based on what both of you are saying to me, it's like this idea, well-being, that's, it's a more expansive aspect and thinking more in terms of like well-being of the community and taking into consideration relations outside of just an isolated individual. Not that that's not important, but that it's like kind of expanding upon it. The final question I wanted to ask, in terms of pushing against narratives of like underdevelopment deficiency, what are some like optimistic stories y'all have heard during COVID?
I love that. I'll just kick it off for the first 3 seconds. I want to hear more from Therese on this, but like, I appreciate that kind of like, yeah, ending on a happy note, which is also to say like, dude, you're like doing the, like, you're like the, what you just said, I feel like is like what I wish like a lot of my public health colleagues honestly like came to the table with. That I feel like a lot of our like burden and labor is like partly in getting the education to our colleagues or my public health colleagues to where you're already at and thinking about this like idea of public health, like way like zooming out, right? Like really thinking about this on a holistic level of like community, like well-being, like what is this past, like, I mean, I too wish I could run like a mile in 5 minutes, whatever, but it's like, it's so narrow sometimes in that how it's framed within the field of public health. So like, dude, you're like, I mean, honorary, like just hand you a few public health degrees and hit the ground running, because that's like exactly what it's like. And so like, yeah, so I just wanted to quickly say that in terms of like, I think like, and just I maybe setting the stage for Teresa's answer is just like, I think like even just how our clan system works in terms of our relationality and how that responsibility to one another happens within this like familial way that's community based is the foundation of like how we think more broadly about well-being personally, individually, the well-being of the land itself, and the well-being of us as people, as a community, and how those things all interrelate. Like it's not like in a silo, right? Like all those things are like currently like in flux and relational of how we are inclusive in this way. And so, you know, yeah, and those aren't just like these like romantic notions or whatever, like that is critical underpinning of like how we should be thinking about this. And you're already doing that work and thinking about like the framing of what public, quote unquote, public health could look like. And so anyway, I just wanted to quickly say that. And yeah, so Teresa.
Yeah, I think an undercurrent of what we were trying to write, and I think comes through very strongly in the end, is this idea of holistic health or wellness, right? Which I think could be subsumed under ideas of ke, right? So you're taking care, you take care of yourself by taking care of others. But also, you know, if you think about environmental health, like our bodies directly correspond to the health of our environments. Like this is not just like a biological fact. I mean, this is an epistemological like idea or truth, I think, in Diné ways of knowing the world. So in that way, it's really quite obvious that like environmental health and public health are interconnected, and our ideas and practices of wellness, you know, necessarily needs to link those together. I think another, I guess, summarizing thought and returning to how Mark and I were thinking together through this is like, what would it mean if public health frameworks were able to account for settler colonialism as like a variable for, you know, health disparity? Like, what would it mean if settler colonialism was like a precondition, right? Because in the reality is, you know, we, all of the material conditions that have been set forth, you know, as a consequence of ongoing settler colonialism have led to all of these health disparities. So it's like, if we actually are more explicitly naming that, like, what does that mean? So I think that was probably one of the things that we were trying to gesture towards at the end of this, you know, short editorial. Because settler colonialism, insofar as I understand, in my conversations with Mark, isn't something that's readily understood or discussed in public health fields. I think it's starting to be something, right? And likewise, you know, as someone, you know, who studied anthropology and now I'm, you know, a junior faculty and I'm trying to develop this next course of my publications and research and really trying to like do things that I think can be helpful and resonate with communities back home and not just this, you know, armchair sort of position. You know, I feel proud that I think this piece could have a more of an intervention in a field right now than maybe other things that I could be writing or doing because of all the things that Mark has mentioned, right? That there hasn't been this much of a discussion within the public health field and also within our own communities and our understandings of public health. And so bringing these two things together and having, you know, a conversation about it and developing the terminology to discuss these things, I think is really important. I think there's one other thing I wanted to mention and I can't remember what it was.
Well, while you're thinking about it, because I'm sure it'll come back to you and it's going to be blow us away, because just kind of returning to this idea, like maybe like framing it out a little bit more too. I think like, because I think there's like multiple levels here. There's like the political reality of the Navajo Nation, right? And then like the like community level and then like family level. And I think there's been like these minor wins at each one in how we've responded to public health crisis of COVID. And I think that another thing that comes up often in public health is just this idea of data, right? Data sovereignty, who owns the data? How are we looking at this data? Who's looking at the data? Academia as a whole has always been just this outside entity that has always like, we've always been under the microscope or like on the other side of the lens as a community, right? Like even from the formation of the starting point in my mind is like asking a question of like, how has COVID impacted us? How do we want to understand like this? Or how do we understand this from this historical narrative of previous pandemics and how it's affected our community to like these branching out points? And if we do that from like a non-community, like non-whatever or Western way, like we're going to go start forming these routes of like the actual like ontologies, the methodologies, how we analyze the data, how we interpret the data. And each of those have a different branching point. And if we ask questions that are relevant to us in how we want to be relational and understand those, and like maybe like a lot of people in community, like your example is a perfect example of like within community, how we're responding to these. And there's a lot of like good examples of that. And I think also in thinking about how we respond to like this idea of like how we're able to try to think about what this like collection of data looks like. And I feel like can be these notions, like my dad would talk about, like why are we not thinking about the earth itself as a research partner? You know, like how do we think about like the animal world and like how we think about the spiritual world? And that is just an idea of like that, going back to this idea of the starting point, like in Western limitations, like that's one of them, right? Like they're not framing the research question that way. Therefore, they're not using worldviews that way. Therefore, they're not using methodologies that way. Therefore, they're not analyzing the data that way. Therefore, they're not like interpreting the data that way. That may in the end not be as meaningful to us doing the work that we want to do in the way we want to do it per se.
Oh, like what I wanted to say in response to your question about leaving on a note that's not just focusing deficit narratives. So in the piece, you know, we briefly mentioned, you know, mutual aid organizing, like an info shop, but you know, there's a ton of other groups that are doing this work as well. And I think the importance of framing Dene responses around as a sort of public health intervention is because you know, this is about community care and health. It's not just about you know, an individual's right to not wear a mask. And I think I would argue that that is the reason why the Navajo Nation has been more successful at their vaccination campaign more than any other state. When I say this, because you know, there's all of those comparisons of the states and how much they have vaccinated. And then if the Navajo Nation were to be put on the same scale alongside states, the Navajo Nation would have been the highest. And yes, we unfortunately still have some family members and those who refuse to get vaccinated for many different reasons. However, you know, as a whole, like most of our families and communities have been vaccinated. And, you know, I was back home a few weeks ago, Bash still has temperature checks when you walk in. And, you know, all of these public health measures, you know, by Western standards, alongside Diné-centered measures, you know, through ethics of care and relationality, I think together have actually created a really positive response to the vaccine. So we've gone from being, you know, a global hotspot for the pandemic last year with some of the highest rates in the nation to now having some of the lowest rates. So, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, we don't know the future direction of the Delta variant or on any of these other variants that could arise now as we're moving into colder weather. But, you know, I hope and pray that some, you know, that the vaccine will be successful in helping curb a lot of the positive infection rates on the Navajo Nation, because we have lost so many, like too many in our communities.
Yeah, Teresa's so on point with that. Like, I just really am excited about, like, so, and I think that, like, also can, like, relate to, like, how we're framing out maybe, like, these next steps. Because, like, at the time we wrote this commentary, like, vaccines weren't even available. Like, we started this back early beginning part, like, actually, like, starting last year in the winter time. And so even just kind of the theme of, like, which I feel like is just an awesome theme to end, like, on, is just this less deficit framed outcomes or whatever. And what we're talking about, I think that broadly, like, one of the biggest wins, right? Like, in terms of what Teresa's saying. And so that's so on point. And I think, like, that might be kind of like maybe some of the next steps of how we want to move forward with this is, like, describe that too and have that out there in whatever form, like, that would be, like, most impactful in. I think like within that, like, relational based reality, I think helps kind of frame, like, how we've had these bigger wins in terms of vaccination rates and in terms of, like, how we think about, like, taking care of community, some of that messaging within public health. We didn't get a chance to talk about it in the paper per se, but I feel like maybe the next one will have, like, that kind of, like, positive framed idea of, like, how we're relational, like, framework or mindset of what it is to take care of our elders, what it is to take care of our community, in terms of what those vaccinations look like and why they've been so high. And I think that's a good, like, basis for thinking about this positive win. Like, look at us as a case study, like, quote unquote, in terms of how we've been able to incorporate these things in terms of this other aspect that we have a lot of reason for, like, medical mistrust. We have a lot of reasons to, like, not, like, there's a lot of these systemic things that we're trying to, like, frame as well in the history of, like, why we might not want to get a vaccine or why we might be reluctant to go to the doctor or even access to getting to these facilities. Yeah, I guess I'm kind of, like, meandering here, but basically, like, I think incorporating, like, a lot of that, a lot of those, like, reasons and barriers that are overcome are a huge win, right? I mean, that's amazing. And, like, I think we've done that, like, through these grassroots efforts a lot too, in terms of, like, what that framework of how relationality can look like. And I just think that's such, like, a great example that, like, people outside of our community could really, like, I don't know, learn from, or, like, they would want to hear about, right? I just think that would be true.
I was also gonna say, if all three of us run for council and we win, we could take over HESI. Okay, I'm just saying. HESI. It's four people. That's we just need one more person. I'm just kidding. Anyways, yeah, I just wanted to say.
You have to pronounce COVID-19 with the Kosnitz-Agi.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to say a bad word in Navajo, so I'd rather not. I've made that mistake.
We'll keep that part out or whatever.
But yeah, I wanted to say thank you for joining me. And I, you know, I had a great, you know, discussion, and I really like the paper. And I think a lot of people could benefit from reading this. And as you mentioned, Mark, the outside communities could benefit from this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.